Straight Jack, episode 14. Yes.
Unlucky for none.
Just to say what we do, we review three films each week, all with a similar theme.
Theme.
One new release, one post-2001, pre-2000, and this week the new release was chosen by Ian.
Which was The Childhood of a Leader, which is the directorial debut from very good actor. If you go, has only done good films, Brady Corbett, and it is just a wholly fictional film set in 1919, set in France, I believe. It's during the creation of the Treaty of Versailles, and yeah, it is just about a young boy who we are led to believe will grow up to be a fascist leader, and this is his childhood as told through several chapters, which are sort of bookmarked by separate tantrums. How did you guys feel about this? Ooh, that's bad.
No, I just think...
I don't mind... Oh, God.
For me, this film, and I'm still settling on this, has asked me so many more questions than it gave me answers. And I think maybe that's what it's supposed to do.
Yes.
But there's so many parts in this that I just don't quite fully understand exactly the ramifications of what they were and reasons behind why people did certain things. Just the how profound this film is, I'm not quite sure yet. Actually, none of that makes
sense. I'm not sure if this is where you're going with it, but I feel like this film is quite confused, and to an extent where I, as the audience, are confused. The plot is quite confused, and the director himself is quite confused about what he wants to portray.
See, I would say the direction for me is the strongest aspect of this film. I think the direction is completely spot on. I just think that there is something underlying that feels like it's trying to get out. I think it's a script thing. I'm not entirely sure. I think they're... Is it all sort of purposeful that we're supposed to be this bemused? Perhaps it is. But did that then therefore take away from you? Because you've obviously got like a style versus substance argument. For me, it was the style that almost was the substance. And the style is what kept these sort of quite awkward, peculiar scenes sort of going. Did you?
But it was the moments of really quite stylized and quite interesting bits interlinked with a 20-minute long debate with Robert Pattinson, and it just I didn't know what it was getting at.
Yeah.
Because of that sort of weirdly constructed mismatch.
Yeah.
It just didn't work for me.
I quite like some of the scenes of dialogue. I mean, I think from a technical perspective, there are certainly some elements of this that made it feel unique, and maybe that's me being oblivious to actually whether it's...
Wholeheartedly.
But it felt there's some really... I mean, first of all, the score, which, as I was saying to Robbie when we came out of it, I couldn't think of a word for it until the ending, where it then came to me, you know, it was a real villainous score. It just felt evil and just something sort of wasn't quite right about it. I mean, there was, again, I think I've talked about exposition in every single film I've ever reviewed, but that's what I liked about the start. It wasn't as on the nose as what it could have been, and a lot of what these kind of films would try and do, it tries to set the scene about where we are and what's happened, whereas actually it was quite subtle like that. You had to build up...
It's guesswork almost.
Yeah, and it was almost that... It was only after probably the first 20 minutes when you saw Robert Pattinson for the first time. He's obviously been discussing with Liam Cunningham for quite a while. They clearly have a difference of opinion in some ways. And it's only then that he talks about the Treaty of Versailles, and then you begin to realise who Liam Cunningham's character is and what his role is in a story that we don't necessarily know very well, but anyone who studied some basic history would understand what the Treaty of Versailles was and what it was getting to. So, and when we talk about the technical perspective as well, the camera, and I don't know whether I noticed this or not, but it just was always seemed to be moving. It was never static. It was always moving. It was some really long takes, some really long shots where it either followed a character or the character stayed still, but the camera just kept on moving.
I think they're playing pool, and it's it's outside looking in. It's, and you look in the corner and you're like, oh no, it's moving. It's creeping.
Yeah.
And then it's that wonderful, then the pool cue and the...
Yeah.
I think it did win a cinematography award at Venice, possibly.
Did it? Okay.
But there is a real range. Like you say, that in between the chapters, there are bits, like a cathedral, just like corridors and sort of where Stacey Martin's character and the young boy, and it just sort of pulls out, and it just has this sort of distorted kind of wide angle lens. A lot of thought has clearly gone into it to make it look this way.
One criticism I did have of it, and I think you probably agree with this as well, it was so slow. It felt so much longer than the 2 hours.
It was drab.
Yeah, but not in a way that didn't make me appreciate it. I didn't come out thinking, oh, actually, I've already presented it as a criticism. It's not really a criticism. But I did struggle with it at times. I did come out of it thinking that felt like a three-hour epic, whereas actually it was, I think it's just short of 2 hours.
It's a negative. It just felt really long.
Yeah. For me, absolutely. I think it's because a lot of the scenes were very long. There probably weren't that many actual scenes. It reminded me an awful lot of Michael Haneke, and especially, I don't know if you've seen The White Rhythm, about, obviously, a very similar kind of thing, the birth of evil. And yeah, I think I totally agree that it felt longer. That for me was its greatest strength, because as scenes would go on and a minute would pass, a few minutes would pass, I'd be like, oh, what on earth is gonna come at the end of this? And even though not all of them came with a big explosion or a big revelation, although some of them did, and the score has obviously
the score is so powerful.
This unease that I think just lingers in the corners, and you're sort of looking around, you're waiting for something to go off. And like in a completely different film, but the way that Boyhood sort of works, it's just life is just happening, and it's waiting for any. You felt like anything could happen in the scenes in Boyhood because it was real life. Here, for a sort of in a similar way, it's like someone's just going to run out with an axe any minute because it's so grim. And I mean, everyone is pretty. I think you used the word drab earlier. No one's particularly happy in this film, are they?
Everyone's tense about something, but that's the backdrop. When you think about the Treaty of Versailles, when you think about World War One, I mean, imagine what Europe were going through. I mean, everyone was probably feeling a little bit hostile towards another, or at least on edge about something.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't touched upon the kid yet, and not necessarily the acting, but more about the character, which is obviously he's the protagonist, I suppose, really. And he's obviously the titular character as well, but. Thoughts on the character itself, because this is where I'm open-minded, because I'm a little bit torn on this.
Was it a sort of a commentary on nature versus nurture?
Really, really interesting that you said that,
because I felt like, thinking about it now, I feel like it firmly sits on
nurture,
on the nurture side,
his upbringing.
Completely on his upbringing. Would he be a leader? I mean, there's no spoilers here because the spoiler's in the title. He becomes a fascist dictator.
For me, it's interesting, because for me, the leader is the irrelevant part. It's more the fascism that's the interesting part for me, because I agree, the nature versus nurture. For me, the leader, it's not about him exhibiting sort of leadership behaviours previously in his childhood. It's more about some of the behaviours he does show in his childhood and more.
What sort of leader he is? Not the fact he is one, but is he...
Yeah, what drove him to obviously inevitably become what he became? And I think he's quite clearly, it's shown throughout it, he's sort of abnormally smart and incredibly intuitive, incredibly temperamental as well. I mean, he loses his temper very quickly, hence the chapters of tantrums. And then for me, it was exactly as you said there. Do the events shape him into what he becomes, or... what did he always have that inherent within him, and it was just inevitable that something like that was going to come out of it.
And the fact that it opens with him being a bit horrible.
Yeah.
That opening scene is him throwing rocks, I think, just, at a crowd of people.
And we haven't seen an instigating incident. It's just, he just starts chucking rocks.
Outside the church, you're assuming it's unprovoked.
And his classmates as well, I'm pretty sure.
Just made me think it was completely nature, and he's just inherently evil.
The film, especially that first chapter, is just sort of going... what form is this film going to take? I know the title, I've seen a bit of a trailer. We need to talk about Kevin. It was just because we first started watching that, and you're like, this guy, this little kid, he's just been but he's always been like that because he was a baby in the first scenes. Yeah. And then you sort of, it's a very good point to bring up, because you are totally wrestling and going, and then some things do happen, you go, oh no, but they weren't very nice. And is the word authoritarian? Like, they're doing things and he's this respectable member of the community. We've got to talk about Stacey Martin's character, who comes in as a French teacher. There is an insinuation sort of later down the line where then he sort of mistrusts her, and then he just completely goes out of his own way to try and sort of get rid of her. Was it her impact on his life? Is that what it's trying to say? Is that what shaped him?
Was it that? Because he was already an idiot. I don't know.
But just throwing stones once, because he apologises. But then
he doesn't want to, though, does he?
Oh, no.
He never feels remorse.
No, he's saying it. He's saying it through gritted teeth, for sure. But then, does he then speak to the the priest, you know, the vicar, and then does he sort of get over it and then drive
it? I don't know. It's
and that's
so
the questions. You're completely right with the first thing I think you said about this film. Just it does ask so many more questions. And I thought giving it 2 weeks before doing this podcast, having seen it, I thought I'd have more answers. And I've thought about it a lot, yeah. and I've got no more.
But then again, it reminds you of that bit in The Office where, you know, in the Christmas special where Brent says, you know, it's an absolute stitch-up. They film loads of footage, and then all they show is me being an idiot. And you almost think, you know, actually, what we're watching, I know it's obviously fictional, but what we're watching is his chapter of tantrums, but we're watching 2 hours, inevitably, of a very condensed version of sort of the indications of sort of evil and tyranny sort of growing. Whereas actually we don't see perhaps the lighter side of things, or you don't see the things where actually he's just a normal kid. But the thing is, I think what it does very well, you quickly hate him, don't you? But there's actually bits of comedy in this. There's absolutely bits of humour, particularly in some of his reactions. And yet I absolutely despise him. He's horrible.
See, I didn't despise him. I thought that was the initial point they were making. Everyone's walking around in black. They walk around the village and everyone's so glum. I thought, oh, if I was raised at that point in time and I had a mother and a father like that, and then the one light in my life who comes to see me to teach me a wonderful foreign language then goes and in some way lets me down, and everyone thinks I'm a girl just because I've got long hair and I look cool, like, I don't blame, I would be furious. I'd act like, I'd play out, I was totally on his side the entire way.
But his reactions, and, you know, particularly towards the end, but just some of the things he did, and he said, I can't believe that that is something that he has learnt, or that he is the product of his environment. For me, that's inherent within him, and that's his nature, sadly. And he was born, whether he was born with a temperament like that, or he was born with the propensity to get a temperament like that, I don't know. But either way, I felt like he was sort of evil incarnate is too strong. Because we don't know what he goes on to do, really. But it's this idea that he was always going to be destined for being a little brat.
But that's almost the white ribbon does ask that same question. It sort of tries to show, and to an extent you go, oh, I can kind of see why they would go on to get together and be so upset and cause these atrocities, but not to the extent of the atrocities they then cause. It feels like a big jump. And again, because how old do you think it was? 9, 10
Yeah.
We're obviously a lot is left to the imagination by the time the last time you see him.
Can you imagine our mums watching it and saying, 3 tantrums in a year? That's nothing.
yeah, exactly. It's done nothing. How would you guys score this?
I felt like all the good parts that we've picked out of it were too few and far between, and felt really spread out by the lengthy, boring parts. There were many parts which were quite dull. And just so, so uninteresting to me. And I know you said you enjoyed the Pattinson segments, but I genuinely wanted to leave. I'm going to go for a 2.
Oh, well, okay. I, as well as the Pattinson moments, I actually quite enjoyed the treaty moments, I suppose, when they're having the discussions about war. I naturally, at school, I quite liked history, so I'm sort of fascinated by World War One and Two, and obviously this one particularly deals with one. Part of me thinks this film is an absolute masterpiece about the nuances of sort of the childhood of evil, really, or of an evil childhood. But then, and the part of me wants to see, you know, his adolescence. I want to see the boyhood version of this, where you genuinely see how he progresses. I would love to see a sequel to this. And we probably would want to talk about the ending, but we probably can't go into too much detail. But for me, the use of Robert Pattinson again, towards the end / in the ending, for me was ridiculous. I know that's not necessarily to do with the story, it's more to do with the way they used an actor, but for me that was ridiculous. And for me the ending didn't give me the satisfaction that I wanted it to, but from a technical point of view that is fantastic. I did enjoy that bit, but for me, yeah, there are still some flaws to otherwise what is a really, actually the best word I could use is a really intriguing story and a really intriguing film. I think there's some great things about it, but there's also some flaws, so I have to sit on the fence and go for a 3-star.
It was far from being the film that I thought it'd be. But I just, especially from someone like Brady Corbett, who actors turn directors, and you think, oh God, they're just going to, but that he's bitten off way more than he can chew, and he hasn't quite got there. But the fact that his sheer audacity of what he's tried here, and the level of intrigue, and the fact that we've have been able to discuss it far more than any of the films we've done in the last few weeks. I want to watch it again quite
yeah,
quickly.
Yeah, I would quite happily watch it again, actually.
I don't want to go anywhere near it.
But I reckon we would be able to see if there's any other ways of interpreting the first hour and 55 minutes, I think, of what happens in his childhood. And for me, the biggest compliment I can pay is, as I said already, I didn't want it to stop there. I didn't want that look into the future. I didn't want that flash forward. I wanted to you know, as soon as he'd obviously done what he'd done to his mum, I would have happily seen, you know, the next 40 years. Was like, I wanted to see where else it went and continue this argument and this discussion that we're having about, was it nature? Was it nurture? What happened, man? I mean, we saw his childhood, but what happened after what we had seen?
It's always a good sign, isn't it?
Yeah. So I, as I said, I'm completely intrigued by this film. I was just left wanting more, which is maybe actually a good thing.
Yeah, I'm exactly this, virtually that, but I think there was enough stylistically and in sound that I just, almost, not that I haven't seen before, but put together in this way, all in a film. And I was sort of, especially by the end, even though I'm still, as we found out here, I'm still pretty unsure about what went on, but that certainly for me has never been an issue. It's all about how it makes you feel, and there was a lot of intrigue, and I would have to give it 4 stars. And on to
post
James.
Yeah, post 2000 alternate history, which was my choice, which was QT's Inglourious Basterds, set in 1941 in Nazi-occupied France. It sort of chronicles the fictional story of a group of allies, I suppose, charged with the task of killing Nazis, but doing it in a way that is supposed to spark a reign of terror, really, amongst the Nazi soldiers, who obviously themselves have created a bit of a reign of terror, and ultimately try and assassinate some of the Nazi leadership. And the crusade of which was led by Brad Pitt, which I'll come on to later, I think. So similar to Childhood of a Leader, in a terrible segue, was, you know, it split into chapters, essentially, this film. There, as far as I could tell, and I was trying to chronicle it as I went through, there were pretty much 5 chapters or scenes, even. I mean, some of these scenes are incredibly long.
Yeah.
There's pretty much 5. I mean, the third one in the middle is a little bit more, there's sort of a bit of back and forth, but really it starts with this.
That first scene.
Can we start?
That needs a whole podcast to dwell on for itself. Yeah. It might be. It certainly would be in my top 5 opening scenes of the 21st century, I think.
This torturous opening scene with Christoph Waltz, who I personally had not seen in anything before.
This was his big, especially for Western audiences. Yeah, Western audiences, yeah. For English speaking audiences.
Yeah, playing the affectionately known Jew hunter, Hans Lander. And it is this, there's so much you can say about this opening scene, but him, and I think I'll dwell on him for now. This scene, in terms of tension, in terms of just this anticipation of something is not quite sitting right here. And him, I mean, his diction, the way he enunciates words, some of the words he even uses, and even just from the idea of just drinking, you know, a pint of their milk. And it's so alarming yet disarming.
He's almost walked into the house with muddy shoes, and you're unsure why. You're like, oh no, it's just a routine check. And then from the way he speaks, and you've not seen, certainly I haven't at the time, anyone delivering lines, someone that's so sinister but so light, and he's so polite, and
it's so clever.
It's a false sense of security,
yeah,
isn't it?
Perfect phrase for it, because it's intimidating, but in such a passive way,
which is almost worse.
Yeah,
it's like what on earth is going to happen, and when whatever does happen, it's mortifying, because we've seen that event happen in countless sincere Holocaust dramas. You've not seen it in a Quentin Tarantino film, no. A director that's so heavily stylized that he used gold subtitles for this, which don't add anything.
But that said, it doesn't shy away from using, I don't know how to word it, but foreign tongue. So many directors would just keel over and go, just make them speak English, even though they're French and German. But Quentin Tarantino just goes, they're French, make them speak French. And I respected that. I don't care about reading subtitles.
It's probably his, because he's earned that sort of right from the studio, let him do produce the film he wants to do, whereas certain studios might go, we'll give you the money, but we need English language, obviously, for the market. But
no, and no one...
He doesn't subscribe. He does what Quentin Tarantino wants, and that's what this film is.
And no one does dialogue better than Quentin Tarantino. And when we talk about the language, I mean, it's all well and good, the actual accent behind it, or... whatever language that they're using, but they have to have the words to be saying something. And you just think the communication in this, I mean, the dialogue in this film is just off the scale. I mean, it always is with QT, but this is just some of the conversation, some of the back and forth, some of the threat, the intimidation.
Almost the microcosm, the one scene with Michael Fassbender. He has said that it's his greatest scene. I think you'd almost, you probably would, I mean, everyone's got personal favourites, you'd struggle to disagree with him. Down in the cellar, everyone's trying to suss it. How long is that scene? Like 20 minutes?
Oh, well, and that's what we think when you think about how this film is 2.5 hours long and is pretty much split into five different sections. So it is almost half an hour each. So it probably is a fair time down there where the suspense is just building, this danger that is just lurking beneath the surface. But that scene is pretty much perfection. I mean, when we think about Tarantino, there's some iconic moments in Tarantino. You think about the Reservoir Dogs, sort of like the ear scene. You think about the Pulp Fiction dance, that like the Kill Bill punch and as well as other things in Kill Bill. And then for me, that is the iconic scene. I mean, the first scene is phenomenal, but that scene down there and the use of the the hand gestures and just, oh my God, I mean, that scene, every single scene just brings something new and something that I haven't seen before. It's just a joy. It really is a joy.
It's tense from start to finish. And he uses tension in so many different ways throughout as well. That scene that you were just talking about, we're tense because we've got this kind of, we know something's going to go wrong feeling in our stomachs. You've got the strudel scene where
that's a way more conventional. You've seen that in a lot of war films.
Exactly.
Where people are there through grit.
He's up there with Josh Brolin in terms of making acting whilst eating just off. Spot on.
But we're tense because we know what he's capable of and we know she's got a hidden past. Yeah. And then we've got the opening scene. We've got no reason to feel tense apart from his Nazi get-up, which, you know, just instills sort of tension from the
off in any film. It doesn't just ride on that, sorry,
exactly.
Does it?
Exactly. There's 10 minutes of us having no idea why we're tense, but it's just there. And then when it's revealed why we feel tense, it's even worse. I started to list the amount of times I felt tense and then just realised it was, my bum was squeaking from start to finish. It was I was so unnerved and it was just brilliant.
But I mean, I know I keep coming back to him, but Christoph Waltz, I mean, he's so good in this because you think about the language he's using and the dialogue he's using. It's all well and good he can say what he says, but none of it is on the page would be intimidating, but it's the way he says it, the way he delivers it, and just this air of respect and of danger that he just has in terms of embodying that character. And you're so engrossed and captivated by every single syllable of a letter, of a word that he says, and you're just hanging on.
It's probably amazing. Only Tarantino that could create that sort of character with someone with such a lacking physical presence. It is all coming, like you say, the usual thing that you'd be petrified of a big huge figure. It's all just from the enunciation on the tip of his tongue. It just floors you, doesn't it?
I feel bad for singling him out. I think everyone is outstanding.
Kruger, no. Pitt.
Brad Pitt is terrible in this film.
No,
I think he does what he needs to do well.
No,
Gorlami.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Margheriti. I mean, some of the Italian bit at the end is hilarious. And that is just fantastic. And only Tarantino would have a crescendo that ends in the cinema. I mean, it's classic sort of Tarantino because he's just such homage to
cinema. This might just be my masterpiece. It's that.
Brühl and Laurent. Is it Laurent? Melanie Laurent?
Shoshana.
And
Eli Roth.
Eli Roth is brilliant. Roth, genuinely.
Fassbender, Mike Myers, But there
maybe
is
less
that. That's what I love about this film. He makes it look so effortless, he makes it seem so effortless. But the way that there's all these characters and they're segregated completely into different scenes and completely different parts of this film, and yet they're linked, they're intertwined, and they all come together in this crescendo of an ending. One place, one scene, yes, it goes on for a while as they all do, but it all comes together and culminates. And when I first watched this film in the cinema when it first came out, I hated the ending because it did offer an alternate history to what actually happened. As I said before, I've always been a bit of a loyal historian, so when they did what they did, and when you think,
can imagine you standing with your textbook.
How dare he?
No.
But you've got you've got Goebbels, you've got Hitler, you've got Goering, and Himmler. Yeah, Himmler's there as well, and you think, it's got all the main characters. It's got all the people that we know who are, real influencers and real key characters in this story. Sadly, obviously, it wasn't a story, but in terms of what we know of this history, and yet it does twist it a bit, and obviously it takes it down a road that didn't happen in real life. And I was the Puritan. I hated it, and then rewatching it again recently for this podcast, I just realised just how jovial and just how perfect it was for what it was trying to do.
Jovial's a great word. It's just fun, it's playful, and it is a crowd-pleasing ending. It's giving every... He could have so easily not gone that way. Some of his films do end with people that you get attached to just having a terrible, terrible time, and in the end, he sets up the cake, and he gives you the cake, and you just couldn't be happier by the end.
This is going to sound...
It's the faith. It's, I mean, everyone's seen this film, and I don't want to spoil it, but it's just the special effect at the end in the cinema is just so over.
It's, through the smoke.
You just don't...
The face through the smoke.
You just don't need it. No. The gun shot to... The texture is so OTT and so unnecessary. And then you see it and then you're just like, oh, it's even...
Irreversible even in better. The alley.
But without feeling gratuitous, would you say?
Yeah, not at all.
No, I did get the feel of gratuity, but not in a...
Not in an irreversible
sense. Not in a bad way. More in a, he's just having a bit of fun here, isn't he?
Yeah.
But I think for me, and I've touched upon it before, I don't necessarily get the mechanics of how film and cinema works. So we've talked before about, you know, distinctive directors. Quentin Tarantino, you know it's his kind of film. But also, I never really recognise stuff. But in this film, I think it was the first film I've really stepped back and said, the pacing on this film is perfect because you have these long scenes, long drawn out scenes throughout it. And then it just builds up towards the end where it's just short, sharp scenes. Everyone's doing different things. It's going back and forth and builds this crescendo and it absolutely knocks it out of the park. It's just, I mean, at this point, it's me even going any further. It's 5 stars.
Yeah, it's 5 stars. I think you've got his early career, which I think is rightfully more revered. Like any, like most great bands, they release their earlier albums. It's their original ideas. They've been festering in their head for so long, I think. Jackie Brown, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction are on a bit of another level for me, but this is comfortably the best of the modern career. And yeah, 5 stars.
Tarantino's finest for me. 5 stars.
Wow, finest.
Overall.
Yes. This is
best of the bunch. Better than Jackie Brown. Are you dizzy?
Jackie Brown is brilliant. 1964's It Happened Here, directed by... Kevin Brownlow and Andrew Mollo. So, It Happened Here was a film that was 8 years in the making. These two young lads...
Guinness Book of Records.
It is, yeah. Longest production.
Production schedule.
Two kids with a vision. That's the way I picture this. No money, no budget, but it did end up... I think it ended up costing them about £20,000.
Yeah.
It created this 96-minute long alternate timeline about a Nazi-occupied Britain. The film centres around a nurse whose town is decimated by the ongoing... do you call it a civil war? I would call it it's
in this history.
It's Brits against Brits, but with two different ideals.
Yeah.
And it's about her kind of life and how she is affected by these two sides.
Factions. It's a nice concept and... To be honest, I probably enjoyed reading the Wikipedia page after more than I did the film. I think it falls because it almost does such a good job that then it sets itself up to fail for me. It falls into that category of you watch some films that you know are frightfully low budget or something like this. 8 years, that's ludicrous. But then you then go, oh, okay, this isn't just a student. This isn't a kids film made by kids. You go, oh, I should take this seriously. And some of the acting's naturalistic. I don't know if it was intentional or not, the fact it was shot on 16mm and obviously black and white, it did make it look like it could have been like stock archival sort of footage. It added a realism, and with the performances, it had a realism that, intended or not, certainly worked.
Yeah, it at times felt like a documentary, didn't it?
Yeah.
And felt like I was sort of watching a history lesson on when the Nazis did occupy Britain.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, you know, that never happened.
That's interesting because I thought, and maybe I misinterpreted it, but I just thought it was so amateur. I mean, maybe, I think more at the start, and maybe 8 years, it makes sense. Maybe they were struggling when they first started, et cetera, et cetera. But the acting was, for me, it was awful. You could hardly hear a thing as well.
Had a huge issue with that, especially the first reel.
Because it almost made me say, you know what, okay, forget it. The production values are awful. Let's just focus on the story. So I suppose when I've thought about this film, I've thought about where the story went rather than, you know, the imagery and what the film and you know, a cinema experience should be.
It made me sort of appreciate some other people who were around at the time were Kubrick and Hitchcock, and it makes you think, you know, they had similar maybe not a similar budget, but similar equipment that they had access to. I think even, was it Kubrick? Strangelove?
Yeah, yeah.
He was working on that at the time and offered a few, you know, bits of equipment and film.
Yeah, because he heard about the project and went, oh, that's quite cool. And I think as well, it's probably quite endearing that I think one of them was 18 and one of them was 16, when it was conceptualised. And you go, oh, you know what, kids, go off and do your thing. But yeah, I was just saying that, it's low budget, but it's impressive enough that then it goes up to the next level and go, okay, I'm going to take this seriously like a real film. Like when you watch people's student films, you go see a local band at a battle of the bands and you go, oh, well, they're obviously not going to be Coldplay, are they? Because they're your mates from around the corner.
Yeah.
This does well enough to get to that next level, but then you're going, what's next? Where let's really analyse this as a real film that I would pay money to go and see. And then, yeah, it just falls into just being very schlocky and just very, it's just quite dull, isn't it?
There's a lot of filler pacing. Montages.
There are, yeah. That's exactly what
but I like those. They mixed, like, they at least mixed
they're like
it up.
Propaganda pieces, aren't they? It's weird. They just every now and then come out with like a bit of a musical number, or not a musical number, sorry, but like a musical cabaret interlude kind of thing.
Yeah.
Some news cuttings and just some broadcasts.
It did at least mix it up, and it sort of, yeah. I've seen that technique done before where they do like a, was it M? Does it really, really well, where obviously there's this ongoing sort of case, they're trying to find this murderer, and then it goes, oh, it brings you up to speed with, oh, by the way, this is what's going on in the news now, this is where we're at with the case, this is how, in this case, the troops have moved or invaded, you know, they're sort of moving into place, blah, blah, blah. That, I think, was quite good, but it was just, there were so many long scenes of just an Irish woman doing her job.
It's such a short film as well.
Yeah.
It's worrying when there are long scenes that you recognise as being long. For me, the second half didn't add anything.
See, that's where I thought it came into its own.
That's interesting.
I thought the second half was really good. That was when it started to dawn on me. I mean, I know the opening scene is sort of a brutal look on people who have grown up together are shooting each other. You know, they're all within the same country, and I've never really thought about it. I know it happens in many, many countries around the world. Something that hits so close to home and something so out of the ordinary for me to see it happen. And it was like, oh, wow, this is what it's like for so many people.
Yeah.
What did you think of the very, very opening? So where it basically spends the first minute or so, and it just basically says, right, the Germans occupied here, and this is what happens. It sets
necessary.
The scene, it says, right, first minute, all the exposition you need, bang, there you go.
Yeah.
Carry on with the story.
Yeah.
But I prefer it when films don't do that. They say, we'll let you figure it out as we go along.
No, for something, especially and of the time, something so as, and it is pretty ambitious, I think you do need at least that base layer. I don't think, I know what you mean when some films don't give you everything, but I think for this concept, I think you did need.
It would have been 2 hours if they'd, because they would have needed probably at least half an
hour. You would have needed
to
act it out. Yeah. You'd have watched someone being a part of those early sort of scenes.
We talk about 28 Days Later, or we touched on 28 Days Later, the philosophical edges to it of how society is changing or how society is reacting to it. And that, for me, this is what made the film watchable. This is what I enjoyed about the film. This idea of them almost quite apathetically just adapting to their new situation. They just want normality, and if they've got to accept it with the hope that something will happen in the future, then that's what we're going to have to do. And that's what I suppose that's the edge that she takes on it. Hence, so she responds quite well to the occupation, really. She's more into, which is, for me anyway, was more interesting than the standard sort of rebellion that you would usually get in this, where there's this revolution or someone's, you know, resisting against the opposing force, which I liked. And she obviously joins that, I think it's just IA, but I can't, it's something action, but I can't remember what it is. But that group, basically, that she's using it as a vehicle to try and get back to normality, or trying to achieve a sense of normality so she can just be a standard citizen.
She does try and step back from the politics, doesn't she?
But then she's treated like a pariah when she does that from previous friends or acquaintances that she once had.
She does get impaled by the fence she's on in the end.
And for me, there was one really good, and there wasn't as much philosophy. There wasn't enough philosophy for me. I quite like philosophy when it comes to film, and I think there wasn't enough for it. But there was that one terrific scene where they do this sort of metaphor or analogy between fighting fascism and fighting a disease. And they said, you know, sometimes when you're fighting a disease, you have to fight it with a little bit of the disease. That's how you fight it. You let the body build up the immunity to a little bit of the disease with the hope that it then becomes more immune to the larger the larger disease. And that's what there's this, I can't remember who it was that says it to her, to Pauline, but it struck a chord with me where he says, you know, with fascism, you've got to fight
friend,
it with
the family,
it might
friend,
be a friend, or it might
the
be
doctor.
Yeah, I think it is. And if that would make sense, talking about disease. and he says, you know, you've got to fight fascism with a little bit of fascism. And it's only then can you try and become immune to the problem that you're trying to solve, basically. And I loved that. And I thought, oh, that's so profound and poignant. And that was it. There was no more of those little nuanced bits. That I just thought, you could have had them absolutely littered here. All this film is showing is Germany occupying Britain. There's nothing more nuanced about how that changes society and where this goes. And I thought that was like a little snippet into what it could have been if they'd gone a little bit further. But they didn't. They did much more of the physical, this is what happens if Germany occupied Britain. They didn't go with the more psychological and the more societal issues or problems or solutions, actually, maybe, that may have come about if they had thought more deeply into that. But maybe that's me being picky again. There's that historian element of me coming out a little bit.
But the final scene, did you know the final scene, it just went full Animal Farm. And you've got the film is sort of prefaced with the slaughter of people who we sort of immediately attach ourselves to and side with because they share the same ideals as us. And then at the back end, you see them committing the same monstrosities that the bad guys are throughout the film. And, you know, you look at them, you look back at them, just like the end of Animal Farm, and you think, if we were in that situation, would we do the same thing? And it does sort of allude to that, but it just doesn't do it enough.
That's really interesting because I think we've mentioned it, and I'm trying to think what the films were on previous podcasts. I love that when the film makes me think, what would I have done in that circumstance?
And you have to think about it. It's not an open shirt.
How would I think actually it was School Ties, bizarrely enough. This idea of, or it was probably one of the films that we talked about in that sort of relation where there is an injustice or there is what we would perceive to be an injustice, but back then it was normality. How would I have reacted back then?
Would you have stuck your neck out?
Yeah, like, would I have stood up and said, no, this is wrong? But actually, would I have just been the product of my environment and said, this is just normal? I wouldn't react to this. So it's a really good point because I should have thought like Pauline did and you know, consciously thought, what can I do? What would I do? Play out all the circumstances and the scenarios that could be at play here. Whereas actually I didn't engage with the film on that level. And I didn't realise that until you've just said that now. And that makes me even more regretful at not engaging with this film as much as I should
but
have.
But it is hard to engage with because it's so disjointed and it is those moments are so sparse.
The length of the production, I think, it does show, and it does feel, like you said, how can you feel scenes are this long when it's 96 minutes? But it does just feel bloated and sort of just completely disjointed and just it just needed someone maybe with a different eye to sit down and just get it down to 90 and maybe just get it. It just doesn't feel tight at all, does it? But
this is, for me, this is the only pure alternate history film out of these three. The others are like little plays on it, whereas this one is genuine.
But
genuinely, this didn't happen. And when I think about it, there's a new TV series. It's an old book, but there's a new TV series on Amazon, Man in the High Castle, where it's literally, you know, what happens if Japan and Germany had won, and it's, you know, it's set in that era of, well, the US is now split, and it's split with sort of the German occupancy and the Japanese occupancy, and then you've got sort of different neutral states now, and Russia's different, and I love that. I love that idea of, you know, what whether it's dystopian or otherwise, you know, what would have happened if you know, we hadn't won the Battle of Britain. And for me, that's what I did like about this film. It did explore those avenues. But I have seen the first series of Man in the High Castle, and I feel that did it a better job than what this did. And that's a pretty basic
I mean,
TV series.
It's a trope that is done quite a lot.
Yeah,
and Man in the High Castle wasn't the first.
No,
nor would
no,
it be
absolutely
the last.
Not, no.
But yeah, I think it deserves recognition for what it did. And there were moments where I was quite amazed by the set design. I was like, wow, they've destroyed buildings for this.
Some of the destruction was fantastic.
But yeah, then realised it's because the destruction's real. They've just shot this in their hometown where buildings have fallen due to bombings or whatever. But yeah, like you said, the uniforms and the tanks and the gun, it felt real enough for us to think it was a documentary.
Absolutely. There was a film that it did frightfully, I don't know if you've seen it. It was like a TV film. It's always mentioned when people talk about the genuinely most horrifying films they've ever seen. There's a film called Threads. It's like, I think 1980, 1981. It's what if the atomic bomb hit 70s Britain. Okay. And it shows like a day, like almost like 28 days later. It's got like one day after, 2 days after, and it shows how when the sort of like the oil supply would run out, when how it just reverts back to these basic things. And that was, I imagine, was a far more, I think it was a BBC thing, a far more well-structured, probably a far higher budget. And if you were to watch the two, you'd go, oh, if they'd only had what these had, you can get this impact and you can really show people a really fascinating alternate history, which, like you say, this does actually try and do it. And you can actually have a real, make it really affecting. But yeah, for me, this just didn't have that because of its circumstance. But hey, at least they got it done. And for that reason, 2 stars.
I'm going to give it a 3. It deserves its recognition for its attempt at kind of pushing the boat out and trying something daring. And it does it well, but it does just lag at points.
I'd give it a 2. It's not a unique enough attempt at a very ununique story. I think the story is better than the film itself, and it doesn't do a good enough job of reinventing what that story should be telling. So, yeah, 2 stars.
I think because I haven't seen any of the Man in the High Castle or Threads or anything similar, it was quite new to me. So
I think the novelty of it. It's fascinating. I love the idea of it. I think you could go on. You could, and it's so often done with World Wars, but actually you could do it
with so anything.
Many things. You could see, in 10 years' time, you could do what happens if Al Gore won instead of George Bush? What happens if
Donald
Brexit
Trump
hadn't have happened?
Yeah.
You think actually that you could do it, the butterfly effect, every single action has a reaction. You just think, you could put it down to the smallest thing.
Sitting down with your timelines and trying
9/11,
to like extrapolating it.
You just think, next week, episode 15.
I have chosen Hell or High Water as the new release, which leads us to the theme of heist movies.
I will go for a film I haven't seen, Ben Affleck's The Tan.
And I'm going for the Al Pacino starring film Dog Day Afternoon.
Is it Lume? Sydney?
Oh, is it Sydney?
I think it's
Sydney.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Your network guy, isn't it?
My boy. You didn't realise it was Dog Day Afternoon.
Sure, mate. Who's the guy who always wins an Oscar? He's in it as well, isn't he?
Cazale.
Yeah.
No, he never won one. Yeah.